Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Thank you, Frank. Frank came into the room last night, and I was sitting with some folks, and I said, "See that good-looking guy over there?" And they said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, I get to hang with him in the morning." I'm Helen. I'm an alcoholic. Something else that is important for you to know about me at the onset of my sharing with you today is that I am a sister of St. Joseph. That means I am a nun, if that word means more to you than sister. The important thing, as I'm talking, that you remember is that sisters make vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. And that's significant in my sharing with you this morning. And what a privilege it is to be here. As I share with you this morning, you're going to come to realize why Kansas has got a very special place in my heart. And this is one little section of Kansas that I have never been to before. And it is one section of Kansas that kind of seemed like over the cliff in terms of the edge of the world. And so it is really a very great privilege and pleasure to be here with you today and to be able to share, as the big book says, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. One of the things that is important for you to know about what it was like is that I grew up an only daughter in a house of four brothers and a father that doted and pampered and thought I could do no wrong. As a very, very young child, this only precious little girl, I learned very quickly how wonderful that was. And I worked very hard to keep that love. There was nothing I wouldn't do to measure up. And this, you know, looking back, hindsight being infallible, they didn't put that on me. But as a young child, I began to do superhuman effort kinds of things to be perfect so that those folks would continue to love me. The other thing that's important about my early upbringing is that I grew up in a very Irish Catholic home, in a very Irish Catholic community. Now, you can't get much more Catholic or much more Irish. I was taught all the kinds of rigid thou shalt not or thou shalt that every good Irish Catholic family and Irish Catholic community teach their children. 3 days after turning 18, being very, very innocent and naive, I entered the Sisters of St. Joseph, a Carondelet in St. Paul, Minnesota. And I continued to be taught a lot of thou shalt not and a lot of thou shalt. And in all of this, from my very early upbringing through my religious living, there was a lot of love. Most of the thou shalt nots I put on myself. In my community, if there was anything going on, you know, I was there, good old Helen, you know, the community clown. Nothing ever really bothered me. If there was a problem, parish, send Helen. You know, she'll keep everybody laughing and they'll all survive through this real hard situation. I worked very hard during those years to do all that. You know, my community was asking it of me. And so I did it. At one point in my life, I was sent to a little town in southern Minnesota. It's going to be, for the first time in my religious life, a kind of a respite from the trials and tribulations of hard parishes or difficult principals, because I was a teacher, of course. And I hated it. I hated teaching school. had to work real, I loved the kids, I had to work real hard at teaching them everything they should know in grade one, if I was teaching grade one, everything they should know in grade six, if I was teaching grade six, because, you know, they are never going to have another grade one or another grade six. So it's all on my shoulder. So I was going to go to Lesueur to have sort of just a nice year. I was going to teach fifth grade, no extra burdens. The six happiest months of my community I spent there. And in February, the principal of the school had a nervous breakdown. And of course, good old Helen could take over and whip the kids back into shape. The seventh and eighth graders had just gone wild. And so I was moved from my nice, peaceful little fifth grade up to being principal, teaching seventh and eighth grade, of which I had never taught a day, and being superior of the convent. Now, being superior of the convent is real important in this story, too. In my work with those young seventh and eighth graders, I had to teach math. And I had never taught seventh or eighth grade math before. And math was not really my very biggest accomplishment anyway. So I would be up from anywhere from 7 in the evening till 2, 3 in the morning, trying to keep 3 pages ahead of those kids in math, working out the problem. And when it was time to go to bed, you know, sisters got up at 5:30 in the morning because you had to be in chapel to do your praying at 6. I had a few precious hours, and my mind was going 1,000 miles a minute. And I couldn't shut it off. Now, here's what's important about my being the superior. You know, in the good old days, before the changes in the church, sisters in my community did not drink any kind of alcoholic beverages except for medicinal purposes. We did have alcohol there for medicinal purposes. And the alcohol was kept for safekeeping in the closet of the superior. Me, at that point. So at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, whatever the hour might be, I would be thrashing around thinking, these hours are precious. I have to get to sleep. And that is when I began drinking alcohol, it was bourbon, to go to sleep. I was very naive and very innocent and really did not know what that could and really did lead to. I used it because I was frantic to get to bed. Looking back again, hindsight, of course, being infallible, I realized even then I didn't drink to enjoy drinking. I drank because I needed the sedative, the soft mellowing out that alcohol gave me. During this same period of time in my life, I lifted a movie projector and hurt my back. I had a very good priest friend. We had known one another for years, been friends for years. He had an uncle that was an invalid, and I just loved him, and he just loved me, and it was just all a very good, happy kind of situation. Well, during my time out at Lesueur, being principal, teaching every minute, being superior, limping around with my bad back, he was very, very supportive. He would drive the 50 miles to Lesueur when he had time, and he would be there, and it was really, really nice. When I left Lesueur, it became very evident that I had to have something done with my back. So I did. I had back surgery. And all of this time, you know, as I'm limping around with my back, previous to the back surgery, again, I didn't deliberately think about that, but I drank because that alleviated the back pain also. The summer that I had back surgery, 1970, July 1st, I was in the hospital. It was the time in the Catholic Church when there was upheaval, when Pope John the 23rd had said, we're going to make all these changes. There were many people who were upset about the changes and left. There were many people who thought the changes weren't coming quick enough and left. And in the process of all those folks deciding to leave my community, I felt very abandoned. I watched my very closest friends leave the community. And that was very, very painful. At the same time, there were lots of priests leaving the community. And for Tom, this priest friend of mine, that was also a very painful place to be. During the time that I was in the hospital, very sick from this back surgery, his very best friend left the priesthood. And so there we were. I was very sick, and he was very sick-hearted. And he was there. I was so sick that they wouldn't let people come to visit, but they let him come to visit. Good old father, you know, he'll make Helen feel better. When I got out of the hospital, I went to my brother's in California to recoup in his backyard in the sunshine. And when I came home from California after being gone a month, I walked off the airplane and Tom was there to meet me. And I knew the minute I looked at him that our relationship had changed. And I walked into his arms and I stayed there for 5 years. In the beginning, when we realized what had happened between us, it was exciting, and it was beautiful, and it was brand new, and we talked about it. What do we do now? We had two options, both of us having commitments, poverty, chastity, and obedience commitments. And we decided that this was not what either one of us had chosen. It was not what either one of us planned. We both had our commitments that were very, very precious to us. And it wasn't what we wanted to do. We didn't want to walk away from those commitments. And that was very beautiful. However, in our naiveness or our denial and our minimizing of the situation, we did decide that we could have this lovely platonic relationship. Well, I want to tell you, it ain't so. And it wasn't so. And we got closer and closer and closer. And what I want to say to you right now is that I want to own that relationship for the beautiful thing that it was. I wouldn't trade 1 minute of that relationship. I am a whole, healthy human being, a whole, healthy woman today, because I was able to love and return and be loved. And I wouldn't trade that for anything. But what was a very beautiful thing for me turned into something very destructive. Because, you know, liberated as I thought I was as a sister of St. Joseph in my community, because we were one of the forerunners in communities changing and measuring up to what Pope John was asking us to do, what I realized as I got more deeply involved with this man was that I indeed had not shed a whole lot of my early Irish, traditional, rigid, Catholic, I, thou shalt not, and thou shalt. They were all there. And what I was doing was living contrary to what I was taught, what I believed, what my value system was. And it was in this time that I remembered what good old alcohol had done for me way back in the good old days when I was trying to keep 3 pages ahead of the 7th and 8th graders at St. Anne's in Leesour. I remembered alcohol, how it had calmed and soothed and mellowed out the anxiety that was there. And I chose to drink. Deliberate, total, absolute decision on my part. I will deal with the guilt and the fear of being caught and found out with alcohol. And I did. And we would be together, and it would be wonderful. And then we would be apart, and I would be a basket case. And I would drink. Over the first 2 years, I handled that fairly well. In the third year, you know, it got heavy. I kept getting more guilty. We were just together all the time. We worked in a parish together. The other sister that I lived with in a house thought that we were just absolutely the two best matched people she'd ever seen. She was absolutely our very best enabler. She would leave. I mean, she just went way out of her way, you know, to do. She didn't then, and she still doesn't think I'm alcoholic, and she thinks I'm a damn fool for having done anything differently than what I was doing at that time. Anyway, into our third year of being together, I knew this was just getting way out of hand. And so I said to him, this has to end. And it didn't end. You know, we talk about it, but what it did do, up until that time, it had been pretty open between us and between the few people that knew what was going on. The parishioners thought nothing of it because we both worked there. But what we ended up doing was sneaking around even from ourselves. We'd get together and kind of pretend like we weren't. You know, then that was just one more thing to, you know, add kerosene to the coals. It got worse and worse and worse inside of me. And my drinking proportionately got worse. In the last year, I did what I know now, again, was a good old geographical change. I quit my job at this parish. I'm going to get away from this guy. And I went to work in another parish. And so on a regular basis, we weren't exposed to one another. But the sneaking around became more sneaky because one of us had to give in and call up. And each time we did that, we'd say, this is the end. But it was not the end. One of us would always break down. We would go maybe 3 weeks, maybe a month, and one of us would give in. And we'd meet, you know, and that was real guilt-producing and shame-producing. You know, here I am sneaking around like some wanted woman. The last 6 months of my drinking were beyond any doubt the worst 6 months of my life. I had my last drink on January 26th, 1974. And it was, barring none, the worst day of my life. Some of it I will never forget, and some of it I probably will never remember, because I don't remember what happened those last hours of that day. What I remember was that I was supposed to go with a group of my friends in the community to a party type thing. We were going to have supper and we were going to have a mass. And what I found out on the morning, it was a Saturday, that morning was that Tom was going to be the person saying the mass. And I went nuts. And I started drinking. And I don't know for sure how much I drank. I know that I drank a six-pack of Michelob. I can see, and it wasn't, I had to go out and get it, so it wasn't cold. I stuck it in the freezer. And, you know, at this time, I was living with 10 other sisters in my community. And we were living in a square-typed, convent-typed building that had a courtyard in the middle. It was built for 30 people, and there were 10 of us living there. What I remember after drinking the beer and drinking some bourbon was waking up around noon on Sunday morning in my bedroom, in my bed, and I sat up on the edge of my bed, and there were my winter boots. We have lots snow most often in Minnesota during January. Now, my winter boots ordinarily were kept clear across, kitty corner across that courtyard, or all the way around the square. And I saw those boots sitting there, and I had no idea how they got there. And I had no idea what had happened the night before. But I did know from some deep, deep place inside of me that whatever it was had been pretty terrible. And I can remember sitting on my bed and looking at those boots, and I was sick. Oh, I was sick from the liquor. I was sick from the situation. I was terrified. And sitting there on that bed, I knew that I could not live one more day the way I had been living. The next day, I went to a sister in my community whose job was to be personnel director, counselor for our sisters. Mary was a good friend of mine. I'd known her for a long time, but I'd never shared any of my personal struggle with her before. I had never shared any of my personal struggle with anyone, you understand, because good sisters of St. Joseph do not do the kinds of things I was doing. So I went to Mary, 9 o'clock on Monday morning, and I told her about Tom, and I told her about the drinking, and I said, I cannot live another day like this. I need some help. And it just happened that Mary had a bulletin, brochure type thing, sitting on her desk, and she handed it to me. And she said, Helen, why don't you go and get some good help right now? You're ready for some help. And I looked at this brochure, and it was a brochure for a treatment center for alcoholism called Valley Hope in Norton, Kansas. My God, where was Norton, Kansas? I looked at the brochure, I looked at Mary, and I said, well, what would it take? And she said, a phone call. And I sat there, and I don't know how much time elapsed. It could have been just a few seconds, it could have been some minutes, I don't know. But we sat in silence, and Mary didn't say a word. And I really believe that the greatest grace the God of my understanding has ever given me was to finally be able to say to Mary, okay, make the phone call. And that was 9 o'clock on Saturday morning, on Monday morning, and Mary and I were on an airplane at 7 o'clock the next day, flying to Omaha, Nebraska, to rent a car to drive the rest of the way to Norton, Kansas. We have since found a better route. Because since I went to treatment, there have been 17 sisters in my community who have gone to treatment. Now, just somehow, there has been permission for those folks to come out of the woodwork since that time. But anyway, we rented a car and we drove from Omaha to Norton. Now, I don't know if you have ever driven through that part of Omaha and that part of your illustrious state, I want to tell you, it is desolate, God-forsaken, awful, barren, and it fit absolutely how I felt inside. And at one point, I looked at Mary and I said, my God, what good can come out of Norton? Well, we drove into Norton, and I was driving. And we have also since found a different way to come into town. But the way we came into town brought us up a street where Valley Hope came on the right-hand side. And as we got closer, I looked up, and here was this sign. I mean, it filled the whole sky. It said, Valley Hope, alcoholism. That was the word that just vibrated. Well, we drove in. It was 3:30 exactly on the 29th of January, 1974, and it was a Tuesday. And I will never forget that either. The very first person that I met was a gal who, through these years since, has continued to care about me, to love me enough to be here today, this weekend, to share with me. And lots of you know her, Elaine Kanakandoffel. Elaine admitted me to Valley Hope. And somehow, her treating me just like another human being, you know, not this god-awful person that I was feeling like, and her saying to me, oh, we're from Minnesota. I somehow knew, I didn't know how, but I did know it was going to be okay. Later on that day, I ran into Elaine again as she was going home, and she had this great, big, I mean, he really did just seem just monstrous to me that day, gentleman at her side, and she said, Helen, I want you to meet Bill, my husband. And Bill shook my hand. I can still see him. He had this bright red jacket on, and he said, Helen, welcome to the land of the drunks. Oh, and you know, I was such a phony. He didn't know how terrible, what a stab in my heart that statement was at that time. I almost died. Drunk? A drunk? Me? Mm-mm. Well, that was on Tuesday, late afternoon, and on Wednesday morning, I found out that Bill was going to be my counselor. That was the second really wonderful thing that the God of my understanding did for me. And again, since that very day, Bill's care and Bill's love and Bill's support has been there and has been shown in lots and lots of ways, lots of phone calls when I need to talk, lots of miles covered when I'm going to be in a vicinity where he and Elaine can come and share the weekend, and he also is here today, and I'm very, very grateful. They are two very important people in my life, in my sobriety. Treatment, for the most part, was a big relief for me because it was the first time in all of those years I was able to share what had gone on. My first session with Bill, he said, okay, Helen, what brought you here? You know, I didn't think when I went to his office I was going to be able to tell him one word. And I started talking, and it came pouring out, and the tears started to come, and I was trying to tell him between my tears what had happened. The greatest thing that happened to me that morning was that he let me cry. I hadn't cried for years. I've shed a lot of tears since. But that sharing and that being able to cry was the beginning of my healing. Every day that I was there was not quite that wonderful, however. Treatment, and some of the folks, some of the wonderful speakers that we've had here this weekend have alluded to that, have said it, that treatment's only a beginning. And for me, treatment was just that. It was a beginning. And in treatment, I did some very important things. One of the things that I did was do something about that relationship. I had to make a decision what was going to happen in that situation. I knew it could not go on the way it was. The third weekend I was there at Bill's gentle persuasion, I wrote a letter to Tom. And remember, I had said this 100 of times. This has to end. I'd said it right into his face. And it hadn't ended. And it hadn't ended inside of me, which was really what was important. I wrote that letter, and I said, this is it. This has to end. There can be no more. And I'm putting it in writing for safekeeping. And I still have a copy of that letter for safekeeping. On Monday, I had another time with Bill, and I handed him the letter at the beginning of our session, and he read it. And he sealed it. And he handed it to me. And I put it face down on a table that was sitting beside me. And during the whole rest of that time, Bill and I were together. Tom's name didn't come up. I didn't think about him. We got about the business of dealing with some other important things. And when the hour was over, Bill walked across the courtyard with me to mail the letter. And I put the letter in the mailbox. And from that moment until this moment of my standing here, I have not had 1 second of regret at the decision I made. I have had some very painful moments over that relationship since that time. I have missed him. I have been lonesome for him. I have been angry at him. But I have not had 1 moment of regret over the decision I made that the relationship had to end. And that is the third greatest grace the God of my understanding has ever given me, because I tried, and I cannot tell you how hard I tried to let go of that man, and I could not. So that was a direct, absolute gift from the God of my understanding. To be free inside myself. Something else that I was able to do in treatment. You know, when I went to treatment, I wasn't able to put the word alcoholic to me. I wasn't even able to think the word. I was so ashamed. Alcoholic, drunk, had such a terrible connotation to me. That I couldn't even think it in my head, much less apply it to me. One of the things that I was able to do while I was in treatment was admit that I was alcoholic. Now, I'm saying admit, and admit is important, because that's really all I did. I hated it. I hated being alcoholic. No nice lady, and for sure no good sister of St. Joseph was an alcoholic. But I was able to admit that I was. Something else that I was able to do while I was there was to come to some reconciliation between me and my community. You know, I had moved emotionally and for the greater part physically away from my community. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do about that. And while I was in treatment, I was able to make a comfortable decision that indeed I wanted to go back to my community and start rebuilding my relationship with my community. The other very important thing that I was able to do in treatment was I was able to make some reconciliation between me and the God of my understanding. I had moved far away from God. You know, I was living contrary to every value I ever had. How could I possibly look at God? And I would go into that little chapel at Valley Hope and you know, I would just say to myself, I even said it out loud sometimes, you know, because there was nobody else there, you know, who are you? What kind of a God can I turn to the way I am right this minute with all this rotten, ugly stuff inside of me and be accepted? And every time I asked that question, you know, who is my God? The answer I got was the God of love. And that was a hard thing to hang on to. You know, it almost seemed too easy. You know, I'd been so terrible. I had moved so far away that how could I possibly think that God loved me? And it was here that some of my good old rigid Irish Catholic upbringing held me in good stead, because as a very small child in my home, I was taught by my mother and dad that God was a loving God, that God was a loving Father. And so I was able to hang on to that a little bit. And what I realized was, okay, if the God of my understanding is the God of love, then that God is also the God of mercy and the God of forgiveness. And things started to get better for me. You know, forgiveness has been a big, big key in my recovery. Vannoy, in her sharing yesterday, alluded to that. And what she didn't share with you was something that she did a couple years ago when we were privileged to be together at an AA conference, and she introduced me. And she got up and she said, I want to introduce this lady. And she said, you know, in my early life, I did a lot of things. And the word she used was promiscuous. And she said, you know, I just always thought that God was never going to be able to forgive me. I've done a lot of things. And then she said, I went to see the Glen and I heard Helen talk. You know, Helen is a nun. She's a sister, and she's got these vows, you know. And as I listened to her talk, I thought, my God, you know, she's in a whole lot more trouble with God than I am. So if so if God can forgive her, there was hope for me. And I don't have any doubt that God's forgiven both of us. But I had to work at that. You know, it's like I said, treatment was a beginning. And I was much more quickly able to accept and believe and trust in God's forgiveness than I was able to forgive myself. That was a very hard, painful process. You know, Arthur Miller, in one of his books, has a story that was so helpful for me that I want to share it with you. He talks about this lady who, from her very earliest days of being born into this world, hated herself. And as she grew, that self-loathing, that self-hatred grew in proportion. And in adulthood, she had a child, and the child was born physically and mentally deformed. And her first reaction to that was, well, sure, that's exactly what I deserve. I'm such a rotten person. How could I ever have anything but this ugly child? And every time she looked at that child, she hated herself more. She did all the minimal kinds of things that a mother would do for a child. She diapered, and she fed, and then she ran. She got out of that room so fast because she couldn't tolerate the terrible pain she experienced looking at that child. Until one day, the running became so terrible she couldn't tolerate that either. And she decided she had to do something about it. And what she came up with was that maybe if she could do something showing some kind of care for this little kid, she'd feel better. So she went into the room where the child was. And the closer she got, the uglier the child became. And she wanted to run just like she'd been running every day since she'd had the child there. But she forced herself to keep going. And she got over to where the little child was. And she reached out and she touched it. And she leaned over and she kissed it. And the next thing she knew, she was picking it up, hugging it, owning it. Ugly, grotesque, pitiable as this little child was, it was part of her. And she finally stopped running from that. And the bad feeling started to drain away. And I really believe from the very pit of my being that that's what I had to do with the pain and the shame and the ugliness a total, absolute disregard for those periods of my, for that period of my life, for living contrary to everything I believed and held dear. I had to stop running. I've been running. I don't have to tell you how I ran. You know how I ran. I ran by drinking. It was painful. And I came to realize there was no way to do it except to stop running, to go through the pain. To admit, to accept, and to surrender to the fact that I, Helen, lovely, gentle, caring person that I used to think I was, could indeed do these things. That drunk, I was capable of anything. That was one of the hardest realities I had to deal with in my recovery. That drunk, I was capable of anything. That removing the chemicals without changing my attitude and my behavior, I was still capable of anything. So I had to admit, and I had to accept, and I had to surrender to that part of my human condition and forgive myself. Something else that took a little longer for me to realize, there was a big difference, and there is a big difference, in forgiving and forgetting. You know, there are some things that I did during my drinking that I am never going to forget. And God help me, I better not forget some of it. But because I have been able to forgive myself, when I remember those things, and I do remember, I remember right this minute, it is right up, it's here. It's just all marching across. But I can remember, and I can feel sadness. Sadness that it happened. Because it is sad. I hurt a lot of people, myself most of all, and I can feel that sadness, and I can let go of it. I don't have to grab a hold of the old kerosene jug and pour the kerosene on the smoldering coals and fan the flames anymore, because I have been able to forgive myself. And you know, it's out of that self-forgiveness for me that I have been able to feel deep inside. I always knew it from the beginning in my head that God had forgiven me, but I didn't really feel it, accept it, and allow His healing mercy in my life until I was able to forgive myself. So it's out of that self-forgiveness that for me, I've been able to believe that I have been forgiven. I have been able to forgive other people. And I have been able to allow other people to forgive me. So self-forgiveness for me has been a real key in my recovery. It is a key a day at a time in my recovery. You know, as Marnie so beautifully read, we're not saints. And we're not going to reach perfection. But we're working toward. We're striving for. We need progress. And it's all a day at a time for me to be accepting of the times when I've done my best and it just hasn't measured up to what I'd like it to be. It's also been an important thing of my day at a time living my program. Something else that I mentioned earlier about admitting but not accepting my alcoholism. Now, that didn't just stand still. One of the things that they said to me in treatment was, Helen, you have to go home and go to AA. God help me. Well, again, treatment was a beginning, and I was able, okay, I am alcoholic, and so I need to deal with that. And a lot of good folks were saying to me, get your body to AA. And so I went. And it was God-awful. I walked into this room. It was packed with people. It was a big, big room over in the Midway Club in St. Paul. Everybody in that room but me was smoking a cigarette, The smoke was thicker than the worst alert day in Los Angeles, and I just thought, my God, what have I gotten myself into? But I stayed. And I stayed because those folks were saying, you need to be there. I still hated it, you know. I was so ashamed. What are people going to think? Now here I am. My God, what are we going to do? We got a drunk nun on our hands. Didn't like it. You know, I'd gone these 800 miles away to treatment. You know, my community, by the way, we do have two excellent treatment facilities. St. Mary's, the one I work in Minneapolis, and we have St. Joseph's over in St. Paul. And there are a dozen good treatment centers in the Twin City area. I was way too ashamed. I had to go 800 miles away. So then here I am back, you know, saying, here I am, I'm Helen, and I'm an alcoholic. And I hated it, I resented it, I loathed it. It was very bad. But I kept going. And what I realized one night down the weeks, one night as I was driving home, was that I felt better inside than I'd felt when I'd gone to the meeting. That was some years back. That was 6 years and 2 months ago. And I still go to AA on a very regular basis. And I still go because I need to go. I don't have to have folks telling me so much anymore that I need to go. But I do need to go just as desperately as a diabetic needs to take insulin or a heart patient needs to take heart medication. But my big motivating feeling now most often is I go because I want to go. I like what happens to me there. I like what I see happening to other folks there. And I love the fellowship that I experience there. And about 3 months after I had started going to Midway, this very gentle, distinguished-looking, white-haired gentleman who had 23 years of sobriety came over to me one night and he said, Helen, there's a need in our community to start a group over on West 7th in Randall. And there are four guys, three other guys and myself that are going to start. We're going to open this. We've got this beauty shop that's closed up and we're going to start a club over there. And we want some women. And we would really love it if you'd come with us. And so I went. And again, you know, God has been so good to me. That was such an important milestone in my growth in AA. We went to this beauty shop right next to Schwartz's Bar on West 7th in St. Paul, corner of West 7th and Randolph. We cleaned and we painted and we paneled. And it was my first physical involvement. And we had fun. We had fun. Just a dynamite good time. It was 4 years in October that we did that. And the guys' wives brought stuff for us to eat. And we spent several weekends just biffing that place up. The outside still looks like something the cat dragged in, and Schwartz's Bar has just really jazzed up their exterior. So there's quite a contrast on the outside. However, there isn't any place in St. Paul, Minnesota, or Wichita, Kansas, or any other place that you're going to find any more or as much love and caring as you're going to find in the West End Club, especially on Wednesday and Monday night. It is a wonderful, wonderful place to be. It is a great treasure in my life. You know, and again, what I have come to realize through my involvement in AA, and again, the other speakers mentioned it, that to just go and be doesn't cut it. I needed to work the steps. And as I looked at those steps, the big word in every one of them that leaped out of me and still leaps out at me as I study and reflect prayerfully about those 12 steps one at a time, the word is surrender. And for me, that's been a big, important word because my grandiosity, my false pride, my shame, my self-will didn't disappear when I left Norton, Kansas and Valley Hope Treatment Center. The more I'm involved in this program, the more aware of that I am, by the way. It is something, a day at a time, that I need to work on. I need to work on surrender, not my will, but yours be done. And every one of those steps asks that of me. One of the hardest things I've had to surrender to was step one. Not only admitting, big difference, you know, admitting it is important, but for me, just admitting it didn't allow me to be free and involved and loving the program. So I had to accept and I had to surrender to the fact that indeed I am powerless over the chemical alcohol and I am powerless over every other mood-altering chemical. I didn't use other chemicals, but I know that a couple pills would set me right back into my favorite, which was alcohol. Surrendering to the fact that indeed there is something in this world that is more powerful than I am was a big blow to me. I didn't like being powerless over anything. And struggling with that, my life had become very unmanageable. And today I can stand here in front of you, all of you, and say with just very deep comfortableness that I am powerless over alcohol and my life has been unmanageable. And it is such a good feeling. I don't have to run and hide anymore. I don't have to apologize. I don't have to be ashamed. That was a big chunk of surrendering. It is something that I do on a daily basis. It is something that I know I need to do. I need to remind myself. I need to get on my knees in the morning and say, God, I am powerless over this chemical. And please don't let me take a drink today. And when the day is over, I need to get on my knees and thank Him for this day of sobriety. And in between those two acts, I need to work the other steps. I need to surrender to each one of them. They all talk about moving out of the self-centeredness that's been keeping me playing God. And a day at a time doing that, remembering that, turning my will and my life over to the care of the God of my understanding, I have not had to take a drink of alcohol or a pill for 6 years and 2 months. Something else that I have found out very recently about this program that I knew because a day at a time I had not had to take a drink. But what I have found out is that in my surrendering to this, I know that the program works. The end of September, I got what I realized after walking around with it for 2 weeks was a very serious virus that went into pericarditis. And, you know, the doctor said, well, you've got pericarditis. And I said, what is pericarditis? And so he drew me a picture, and he drew my heart, and I started to get nervous when I saw my heart on this chunk of paper. And he said, there's a little sac around your heart. And pericarditis means that that sac is filled with fluid. And then he wouldn't even let me go home to get my pajamas. He sent me right to the hospital. And the next morning, one of the good sisters in my community came in, and she said, oh, do you know, did you know, Sister so-and-so? And I said, no. And she said, well, you know, she died of this. And I still didn't have to drink about that. And I was out of work for a while, and for a good old perfectionist like myself, you know, and someone who is saving the world, that was a real hard thing for me to do. And before I got back to work full-time, the virus just sort of moved itself a little bit into my kidneys. And I found out afterwards that people die from that, too. And I still didn't have to drink. Now, I didn't like it real good. Let me be real honest about that. I have hated it. But a day at a time, I was able to handle that. 3 weeks ago, one morning, I woke up coughing. And the people at work got very concerned. My boss is a medical man, and he said, "You get your body over to your doctor." And so I took my body over to my doctor, and he listened, and he did x-rays, and he poked around, and he said, "Well, you've got bronchial pneumonia." And he said, "That virus is just going full circle in your body." Now, I have to admit, there were a few times during these months that I have said, "God, what in hell are you doing to me?" But again, to this moment, standing here, I have not done it perfectly every minute of every day, but I have been able to do a measure of accepting and surrendering to the fact that for the first time in my life, I have experienced ill health. It's been 7 months worth of fairly ill health, and I haven't enjoyed it. But one of the things that Vannoy said to me yesterday was, "Well, do you really think this is all God's will?" She was asking me that question. I said, "Well, I don't know about God's will, but one of the things that I do know is that it has been a very good experience for me. Because, firstly, it has proven to me, because it is the first extensive crisis I have had in my recovery, it has proven to me that the program, a day at a time, a minute at a time, an hour at a time, does work. And the other thing that it has done, it has really brought me to my knees in a way that I have never been brought to my knees. And I have had to really turn to the God of my understanding and say, I don't like this at all. But if this is what you're sending, then I trust that today you're going to give me what it is I need to deal with it without drinking." And up till this moment, he's done that. That has come through his program. That has come through the help he has given me, the care he has given me, through the people like you that I have at home that are in the program. So, you know, really very simply, you know, when I look back over my life and realize how really fractured and broken I was in every area, physically, mentally, emotionally, but especially spiritually, you know, I can remember times driving around the end of my drinking, especially those last 6 months, and thinking, I'm going to get cancer or leukemia and die, or I'm going to be in a car accident and get killed, because there is no way I can go on living the way things are. And I didn't have 1 ounce of hope that things could be any different. And through the program, through the steps, through being able to surrender to each one of those steps, to be able to surrender to not my will, but yours be done. You know, I didn't have to die, and I got a whole new life. And the biggest gift I have this day is that I really do believe and I really do trust that the God of my understanding does love me and does care for me and just really does hold me right smack in the hollow of his hand, and is going to give me today, you know, not tomorrow and not yesterday, but today, the grace, the strength, the courage, the people that I need to deal with the realities of today without drinking. That does not mean that everything that happens to me today I'm going to like. It doesn't mean that everything that happens to me today is going to be easy. But I do know and I do trust that I am going to receive whoever or whatever it is I need to handle it without drinking. Being here this weekend, being able to talk with lots of you, being able to listen to the four excellent excellent speakers that we've had is one of the very precious ways that the God of my understanding has helped me to live without drinking. It's a precious gift, and I'm going to take it home. I'm going to have a lot of good memories about this weekend. The God of my understanding has been very good to me. And in closing this morning, I'd like to share with you something that happened to me and for me the day I went back to work after I came home from treatment. I came home from treatment just excited. I had a lot of mixed feelings. I cried all morning the day I left Valley Hope because I didn't think I'd ever get back there. I've been there a dozen times since. So. I've met Bill and Elaine here and there, and, you know, Valley Hope, Norton, Kansas, has had a very important part in my recovery. But I had all those mixed feelings, and the most precious of all of those feelings was the reconciliation that I felt inside of myself. And I was so afraid it would go away. And I can remember driving down Snelling Avenue over in St. Paul on my way to work. And I had my car radio on. And Judy Collins came blasting over the air singing a song that I had heard many times, but I never ever really heard it. And as I listened to those words, I thought, my God, this is the story of my life. This is exactly what has happened to me and for me. And the feeling that I had, just overpowering, I had to pull over because I was crying and I would have hit somebody. The feeling, the overwhelming feeling I had was gratitude. Every time I hear the song, it's still the same thing. It is exactly the story of my life. It is exactly what God has done to me and for me. And the feeling is always gratitude. And so I'm closing up this morning. I'd like to share that with you.
Oh,
Thank you all very much for letting me share with you. God bless all of you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.